Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of October. Before we begin our All Things Political program, we do want to thank you for making the fall membership drive such a terrific success. We raised over $1 million from 8,600 members to help pay for the programs that you hear, like this one. And we also welcome almost 2,000 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you so much for all of your support. It was a rousing success, and you made it so. Thank you. All Things Political this hour, and we're happy to have Dante Chinney with us again. It's been a long time since we've spoken with him, and since we've spoken with him, he's embarked on this whole new incredible project. He is the correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project, and essentially what this is an attempt to understand the United States. They've identified 12 types of places across the United States which are distinct voter communities. We'll talk with Dante about that as we discuss all things political. Dante's been covering politics and the media for more than 10 years. He's worked as a reporter researcher at Newsweek and a senior associate at the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's written for The Economist, Columbia Journalism Review, The Washington Post magazine. He's a native of Detroit. As you know, Michigan has been very hard hit by unemployment. We'll talk about that with Dante. And he's a graduate of Michigan State University. He's written for The Monitor for a number of years. And we'll welcome phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, as always, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Dante.
Hey, how you doing, Kathleen?
I'm fine. It's been a long time since we've spoken with you. And you've embarked on this whole new project with the huge goal of understanding the United States. That's a big mission.
Yeah, and when you really start digging into it, as we have with this project, you really get a feel for just how complicated the country is. I mean, 300 million people spread across the spread across the continental United States and Alaska and Hawaii. We do them too. We started this with the idea of, there's a lot of differences between these different places around the United States, and if you travel enough as a reporter or as anything, and you kind of get out of the major metro areas, which do have a lot of similarities, if you get out kind of into a couple hours out of big cities, you start to see real differences between places. So we started this idea. We started this project in 2008 with the idea of watching the election through the eyes of these different places, and getting past the idea of blue and red America, which really doesn't tell you very much.
Mm-hmm.
It only tells you ultimately how somebody voted. We wanted to get a look at why people, what issues move people, and why they vote the way they do. And then once we got into this and we identified these different kinds of places in America, we realized, you can use this to watch anything. And what the country is going through right now, kind of a dramatic restructuring economically. I mean, this is about, I think ultimately this is going to be, we'll all find out, I think a lot of people suspect already, it's about a lot more than the recession, what's going on right now.
Mm.
And also the changes that are happening politically and culturally, we can use this kind of template we have for these different kinds of counties in the United States and use them to get a feel for the direction the different parts of the country are moving.
Right. We'll talk about what all of them are during the course of the hour, but I know you're from Detroit, and you mentioned more than a recession.
Yeah.
Let's start with that today. This unemployment rate is so high, Dante. It keeps going up. And I'm worried about people who have lost their jobs or who are underemployed. When you're looking at 10% and over 15% in Michigan,
yeah,
something's wrong.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It's very bad there. And that is really about more than just the recession. I mean, I do think that there's a tendency in other places in the country to look back at Detroit or look at the auto industry and say, they had it coming. They didn't make smaller cars, and they had shoddy craftsmanship really for the 70s and maybe the beginning of the 80s. I don't think that's really true anymore, actually, but for a while it was. And it's ingrained in people's minds, so they had it coming. Well, first of all, whether or not they had it coming is beside the point. The point is you have this entire workforce, and it's based heavily around Detroit, but it's in other places around the country too, in auto manufacturing, that has just been completely displaced. And what do you do for those people? That's a really excellent question. And that is about the economic restructuring, because if you look at what's happened with the economy in terms of where the jobs are, you know, those jobs on the assembly line where I grew up, when I say I grew up outside Detroit, I mean, my school district bordered Detroit, and mm-hmm. It wasn't in Grosse Pointe, it wasn't in the wealthy part of town. Those people worked on the assembly line, and those jobs paid well. And they at least allowed the possibility that the next generation could, with the money that was, you know, made by the people in the family, could climb out. A lot of that's gone now. And I know that maybe I do think the unions are somewhat to blame. They got greedy. But I do think that also it's larger than that. It's about how what's happening to the world economy, and those jobs are suffering, and what kinds of jobs are the people who used to work those jobs, what kinds of jobs are they going to get now?
Right. What are they doing now?
Well, I mean, right now, what's going to happen to a lot of people who had those jobs? There's this big talk that we're transitioning to an information economy, and yes, we are. I think we are transitioning to an information economy, but I think that's only half of it. I think we're transitioning to an information/service economy. And a lot of those service jobs, that's what a lot of these, I mean, they're low skill. They're unfortunately also low pay. That's where a lot of people are going to go who used to kind of have the low-skill jobs in the assembly line. They're going to end up going for retail jobs, things of that nature. Those jobs simply don't pay well. They don't offer very good benefits. Look, what this country is embarking on now, in my humble opinion, I think the opinion of economists you talk to, many economists you talk to, is look, we're going to go through 10 years or maybe more of really a rough patch here where we kind of redefine what the economy is about, kind of reposition ourselves. I mean, mm-hmm. the U.S. is not the economic power it once was. I mean, the U.S. is still the most important economic power in the world, I think, but because, you know, China and those growing countries need us to sell things to, but that's changing, you know, and it's, I don't know what the country's going to look like 10 or 15 years from now. This project, the hope of this project is to be able to kind of examine some of that. And actually, out of this project, I'm writing a book right now, and I was just literally like in the middle of writing the chapter on the economy, so this stuff is all very fresh in my mind. I don't know what the country is going to look like. We're going to have to, and I'm not down on where the United States is going. I do think that there's a lot of ingenuity in the United States, and I believe in that. But, you know, you don't change things overnight. There's going to be a transition period, and it's going to be very bumpy.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do we need? Do we need, because it's hard to couple what's going on Wall Street with the rebound there,
right,
hitting 10,000, these huge bonuses taking place once again, and contrast that with the people who used to be in the auto industry in Michigan who mm-hmm. are suffering. Something's off kilter here. There were suggestions quite some time ago that what we needed was an economic stimulus, a job stimulus program in this country to really target those people instead of giving even more bonuses to people who are already making millions.
Yeah, and I think in the end it's more than just a stimulus. I mean, there's the short-term problem, which is what do we do about this recession, which has really made kind of the valley that the auto industry was in, you know, into a canyon, you know. Mm-hmm. It's deep, and it has a long way to climb out now. But even when you get out of the recession, there's the question of what do you do. That's more than just a jobs program. I mean, that's going to require, because you've got to think about what do you do for the children of the people who had those jobs too. College is getting more expensive. You know, we have to retool the entire education system. It's very complicated. I mean, this week we're working with ProPublica. And I believe Thursday is the target date now. I've got to talk to the folks over there today, but we're looking at some data. They've crunched all the numbers for the stimulus, where the dollars for transportation money for the stimulus have gone county by county across the United States. So we're going to map that. And the other thing we're going to do is once we map it, we can tell where the biggest expenditures are per capita. Basically, what type of place the United States is getting the most out of the stimulus so far.
Mm.
And it's very interesting. I mean, you'll have to wait with bated breath until we release these numbers. But it's theoretically going to places that need some of it, but not really to the places that are having the real problems with unemployment right now. And it's not just the auto workers. That's the thing. When we get out, there are these places in America that we look at, these rural places, small towns, not agricultural, but they're kind of small town places where everybody kind of goes to do business. They're called service worker centers. They've been hammered in this recession. I mean, their unemployment rate is much higher than the national average. I mean, they're up around 12%, I think, right now. And that's all around these places. That's the average for all these places around the country. They're not getting much money either. So we kind of have to reexamine where that money went. And I think the other thing we really have to do, we have to find ways to get these people, to get the people who don't have the good jobs and whose jobs are disappearing through the short-term problem. But then I think the long-term problem is going to be restructuring the, you know, how we train people. It's really going to take, it's going to be a lot of years.
10 years, Dante, that's a little depressing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah. I don't like it, but when I look at it, you know, the manufacturing in the U.S. accounted for about 20% of GDP in 1987. In 2009, it accounted for only 12%. Okay, so that's, and you know, we'd already seen a lot of loss by 1987, but it's 12% in 2009. I think that's going to fall further. I mean, we can talk a lot about how we'll come up with these alternative energy strategies, and that's all good. I'm for all of that. But the idea that, and then once we do that, we'll just build those things here. It's like, well, maybe we will. Or maybe it'll still be cheaper to build those things someplace else. I'm not saying it's 10 years of woe and misery, but it's 10 years. We're not going to have big growth. We're not going to have what we had in the 90s or the 80s or the 70s, even, really, for a long time. It's going to be slow growth. And because of our place in the world economy, and just because that place in the world economy means we have to refigure out what our place is in it.
When you look at those 12 types of places, which are distinct to voter communities, do you find that any of those places are doing very well, Dante?
Actually, you know, it's really interesting. There is one place that has really ridden out the recession up to this point, anyway, very well. And there are these places, forgive our kind of silly names for some of these things, but Tractor Country, which is agricultural America, has really actually done fairly well. Right now, the unemployment rate in those agricultural centers is only about 5%. So they've kind of ridden out everything so far. Now, there I was just in rural Iowa, which is where we have a community there we watch that's our agricultural community, and I check in with them regularly, and I was there with the NewsHour last week, or 2 weeks ago now, and they're worried now that they're starting to see the trouble bubble up, and their concern now is as the economy starts to turn the corner, they're gonna hit a wall. So it's going to be interesting to watch them. But when we look at these 12 places and we look at the unemployment rates in them, the foreclosure rates in them, even things like gas prices, it really varies place to place, and they're really living in very different economic realities, and they're going to be dealing with very different economic challenges over the next decade or so.
Dante Cini is our guest this hour. We'll outline what all those places are as well and talk more about political issues. He is project director for Patchwork Nation Project for the Christian Science Monitor, has written for the Monitor for a number of years and also a number of other publications. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, Matt Taibbi will be joining us. He's a reporter for the Rolling Stone and wrote a piece that's pretty provocative and very interesting, Sick and Wrong, How Washington is Screwing Up Healthcare Reform and Why It May Take a Revolt to Fix It. Two phone calls now for Dante. John from Madison, our first caller. Hi, John. Hey, John, are you there? Well, John isn't there. Let's try Simon from Appleton. Hi, Simon. Are you there,
Hello?
Simon? Yeah, hi, Simon. Go ahead. Yeah, we're obviously having some problems here. We'll try, let me give you the phone number. We'll try to get our phones fixed here. We're just having a problem with them. Hearing people, of course. Dante, while we're trying to figure this out, and I hope we can, let's spend a little more time, because I think you've broken down the United States in a very interesting fashion. What are those 12 areas of distinct voter attitudes?
Yeah, and what we did is, and we didn't do this by region. We felt regions kind of are much too vast. I mean, Appalachia was a region in this last election we talked a lot about, and Appalachia includes Pittsburgh and Tupelo. Those are two, you know, very different places. I mean, it's enormous. We thought states were too big, so we went county by county, and we took all sorts of demographic data, everything from age, race, religion, income, occupation, a host of statistics, and we broke down the country's counties, 3,100 counties, into these 12 types. We have areas that we call boom towns, and those are places that have, that in the first half of the decade anyway, were really growing and diversifying, and they were kind of, a lot of them were kind of ex-urban in their nature, kind of the step outside of the suburbs. They've kind of hit hard times now with the foreclosures. We have these communities called campus and careers, places in and around big college towns. You guys obviously have one of those there, and then around Madison. Emptying nests, which are kind of aging, not all retirees, but a lot of people 50 and above and moving toward retirement. We have places we call evangelical epicenters. Those are places with they tend to be located in kind of in the Bible Belt area, but not completely, and they have a high number of evangelical adherents. We have a place called communities called Immigration Nation, which is largely along the Mexican border, and it's a lot of Hispanic speakers. That immigration is obviously a very big issue in those places. Big cities that we call the industrial metropolis. We have places in and around military bases called military bastions. They really do have a unique flavor and feel to them. We have a place called Minority Central, which is, granted, we don't think it's kind of a horrible name, but it was because it's largely the Deep South and with places with large numbers of African Americans in them, but also we also included in their Native American counties of large Native American populations out west. They actually do have a lot of similarities in terms of their income and the issues they deal with. The wealthy suburban areas, which we call the moneyed burbs, there are these folks, places out west, we call counties out west, we call the Mormon outposts, places with large numbers of LDS adherents, and they are truly unique. They're very different in the way they govern themselves. Service worker centers, which we talked a little bit about, largely rural, but small towns, not so much driven by agriculture, and then tractor country, agricultural America in the breadbasket.
Oh, is that ever interesting? You never would expect that that's the nation. That's the patchwork.
Yeah, well, and if you go by the site, it's really cool. The map now, you can view the map and you can see all the different things that are there, but then you can check any number of things. So you could look at, say, what the Obama vote was by county, and you can compare that to unemployment rates. You can compare foreclosure rates in all these different counties in the United States. And you can compare kind of interesting things. Like one thing you can compare is the Obama vote to by county to counties that actually have Whole Foods in them. There actually ends up being kind of interesting correlation there. And we did that because there was obviously the blow up in the healthcare debate
right.
over the CEO of Whole Foods kind of attacking the Obama health plan.
Right. Yeah. Whatever happened with that? People boycotted the store, didn't they?
Yeah. It ended up. It was really kind of the world standing on its head. It was a. The people who normally shop at Whole Foods, Whole Foods tends to be, you know, it's a place where you can buy the Utney Reader at the cash register. It's fairly liberal clientele. And they were boycotting the store. And then all these folks who normally would never shop at Whole Foods were all going in there and, you know, buying merchandise to stand in, you know, to stand in support of John Mackey.
Oh, my.
So, you know, the idea of buying organic broccoli as a form of protest against the Obama administration is just an interesting phenomenon, but there it was. There it was.
We're going to try the phones again. Mark from Watertown, hi. Mark, are you there? Oh, our phone system is never happened. All messed up. That's all right. We'll just keep talking. We'll try to fix it. If we can, we can. If we can't, we can't. We're going to spend a lot of time the second hour talking about health care reform. But I found this fascinating that a lot of these different communities are not in favor of at least what's on the table in terms of health care reform. What's going on with that, Dante?
Yeah, now, it's the interesting thing we think with that is what we've done is the nice thing about breaking the country down this way is anytime you can get a poll, you know, a good set of poll data, you can, with a large enough sample, you can and you know where the people answered questions from, you can break it into these constituent communities and get a feel for how they feel about an issue. So we looked at a Pew question over time. They've asked about people's attitudes toward, I think the question is, the health care proposals being discussed in Congress, so it's very broad. But when you look at that, there are only two of these 12 communities that are in favor of those proposals. And they're the big cities, which are big Obama supporters, and the wealthy suburban areas, which actually, the moneyed burbs, which went heavily for Obama. That's you can really argue that's why he won the election, and those are voters who, they tend to be more swing voters. They tend to vote really more about along the lines of economic issues more than anything else. And those two groups tend to support it. The other ten groups are opposed. But when you ask the question differently, when you ask people, are you in favor of an employer mandate? Are you in favor of an employee mandate or a citizen mandate? You know, to carry health insurance. Even are you in favor of a public option? All these, you know, the numbers completely change, and on the whole, people are in favor of it. I mean, that suggests to us that what's really happened is this: nobody really understands what's in these bills, and we wonder if what we're seeing right now is just kind of these people who are in favor of health care reform tend to be more pro-Obama. They voted for President Obama. The other places, the Obama vote was a lot tighter in a lot of these places, and they're just kind of dissatisfied with the direction of the country in general. What we want to do is wait two months down the road, maybe, and Pew will ask this question again, so we will do this, and get an idea of how these people feel or how these different places feel about this plan once they actually have a better understanding of what's in it. I mean, right now, the numbers are very low, and I think that what it's really about is there are a lot of these communities that really aren't pro Obama, and they're just kind of generally unhappy with the direction of the country, and that is being reflected in their responses to quote unquote healthcare reform, even though a lot of people really don't understand what's in it.
Mm-hmm. And what they're really unhappy about is what?
Well, I think what they're really unhappy about, a lot of them, is just the general state of the country. They don't like the fact that the economy is bad.
Right.
The interesting thing is a lot of them were really unhappy about the stimulus plan because they don't like the debt that the government has gotten itself into right now. I just think when you deal with what the country's going through right now, people, you know, are not going to be happy, generally. I mean, you're not going to find a lot of approval for things. And I think that, so you would say, well, then why, you know, considering how bad things are, why aren't they in favor of health care reform? Because, you know, if they sense that everything's changing, shouldn't they be in favor of that? Well, they're in favor of a lot of the points within health care reform, but they're not in favor of health care reform in general. And that's because they don't trust the government still. A lot of people don't know what they think about Barack Obama, or they don't like Barack Obama, and they're generally feeling, they look at the country and it's just like, well, look how badly things are going. How is the government going to fix this? Again, the polls are all snapshots in time.
Right.
So I think it's going to be interesting to go back and look at that, you know, a couple months down the road.
Well, our guest, the second hour, was making reference in his fairly recent column in Rolling Stone that if you were going to be totally on top of this, that the five bills, the ones in the House and the one in the Senate, three and two, you'd have to read some 10,000 pages of explanation. No wonder we don't know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there is something to be said for the fact that the media has covered the controversy a little bit too much around healthcare. I think that's fair.
Right.
But I also think that if you really want it, there is stuff out there. I mean, you don't have to read, God help you if you're trying to read all 10,000 pages of anything. But I mean, there is stuff out there that explains what these things are about. And I do think that the American population in general is just like, well, when it gets to the point when there's something that I really have to understand, I'll try to understand it. Right now, it's just too much stuff. And, you know, hopefully we're going to get to that point soon because this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a very important vote. I think something is going to end up getting through Congress. I think, well, I don't know what it's going to look like. And it's going to be an issue in 2010. And people, I think, really, how people feel about health care reform, what it really looks like, we're not going to know until the midterms in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the support for the administration from wealthy suburban areas. I was interested in what you said, that may have been the key factor in Obama's victory. What do wealthy suburban areas see as serving them? How are they being served by this administration? Why the support?
Well, I think what happened is wealthy suburban areas, they tend to have a couple things going on. First of all, these moneyed burb areas, they have the highest income of any of the communities that we look at. They also have the most people. They're the most populous because this isn't 12 equally broken out groups. It's clustered around, you know, we look for things that link counties together, and if there are 100 counties in that category, you know, fine. If there are 1,000 counties in that category, fine too. So this is the most populous group of counties, it is the best educated group of counties, and it is the wealthiest group of counties. So I think they look at Barack Obama, and first of all, they voted for him in part because they were the ones who, I think these communities in particular, they're also the ones who are the most invested in the stock market. They were the ones who looked at everything last October and said, you know, oh my God, the world's ending. You know, these are the people who read the business page more than the other community types and say, wow, this is really bad. This could be a collapse. So they wanted change. They desperately wanted change. You know, so they voted for Al Gore by 4%. You know, and they voted for John Kerry by 1%. They gave him 1 percentage point.
Hmm.
But they voted for Barack Obama by 11 percentage points.
Oh my.
They gave him 55% of their vote.
Hmm.
So they liked him in the first place. I also think that there is something that speaks to them from Obama. I mean, he's obviously a very, when you see him speak, a very reasoned, educated person. And I think that they probably, you know, it's very much a departure. The Obama approach to speaking and the Obama approach to governing is a real departure from George W. Bush, and I think that they appreciate that. Now, I don't think there's anything saying that they're going to stay with Barack Obama. This is a pretty fickle group of places, you know, of communities. They could change their mind. I mean, I think 2010, it's going to be very interesting to see what those places do. There are a couple other places like that there that tend to be, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of these community types are set in their ways, and they vote for reasons other than the economy. They vote on cultural issues. They vote on social issues. And there are two or three of them that their vote tends to swing a bit more, and they're voting more based on economic issues. And the moneyed burbs are one of them. The other one is the boom towns, which actually they trend a bit more conservative, but they also vote on economic issues more. And then the service worker centers, they also trend a little more conservative, but they're willing to vote for a Democrat if they feel that the situation is
right.
Merits it.
We're going to try the phone systems one more time. And
hello?
Oh, my gosh, they work. Hi, Daryl.
I can't hear anything.
You can't hear me?
Hello?
You can't hear me?
I have no... Hello?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. I don't know why you can't hear us. Let's see if we got something going on here that's weird on the board. I don't think so.
Here.
Can you hear us now, Daryl?
Hello? No, I...
You can just go ahead and talk. No, it's obviously not working. I'm very sorry, everybody. We've been loaded with phones, too. They're just calling and calling and calling, and we just can't get to you. So we will try again to fix this, and I'm sorry. Shouldn't happen, but that's the way it goes. I want to talk a little bit about the press with you, Dante. When we were talking about health care reform, it seems to me as though, and I harp on this issue, but it seems as though there is this real lack of in-depth coverage about all of the issues that are going on, that the press has picked up on the controversy and the bickering and the sniping at each other. And that's what we hear at a time when we need to understand some of what's in those 10,000 pages of healthcare reform. We need something more. Would you agree that the press has fallen down on the task here a bit?
I mean, I think you've got to assign blame to both parties. I do think that, you know, people have to want to seek things out, but on the whole, yeah. I mean, the press has been much too interested in the controversy. That is the way the press tends to operate. It's, you know, look, it's a lot easier to cover, you know, and it's frankly, if you've got a television camera, it's a lot more interesting to cover.
Yes.
People yelling at a, you know, at a town hall meeting and covering the specifics of bills. I do think the other thing that's hurt the Obama administration is that, look, their approach to this was, look, we're going to let Congress do their job, and we'll jump in when we feel we need to jump in and kind of direct the conversation, but we're going to let Congress come up with these bills. So the fact that there were all these bills floating around allowed people to make, to say things that were, I mean, whether they were or weren't true, they were harder to disprove. If there's just one bill out there and we're all talking about one bill, you could say, well, that's bad because then there's a target. Yeah, but it's probably better than having six targets down there, which is what we had over the summer. But Congress took a break in August, and you had like, you know, five or six different competing versions or ideas of bills sitting out there, and that meant that people could start citing all sorts of random things and throwing it out there. Now, did the press have to cover that? No, they didn't. But I mean, they're going to cover town halls. It's just that they're no brainers in terms of press coverage. I think it is a legitimate point to say, but shouldn't? That's fine. They can cover that, but at some point, don't they have to go back and kind of cover the specifics? I think they should have done a lot more of that. I think we're starting to hit the point now where we're going to start seeing more of that coverage. At least I hope. First of all, we're past the hubbub of the town halls. And the other thing is there's a lot to talk about now, specifics.
Yeah. Well, yeah, after all, we've got to cover Balloon Boys.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, Balloon Boys was a low watermark, I think, for press coverage. And, I mean, not just because of what the parents did, but just the idea that everybody was watching a balloon fall across the television screen for 2 hours last week was really depressing.
Wasn't that something? My son came down and looked at it, and he said, "Mom, this is a hoax." And I said, "Well, maybe it's not. I was kind of caught up in it, too, this little kid. And I was watching the TV screen, watching this balloon float. This, what a bizarre story." But he was onto it right away. "I don't think this is true." And he was right. He was absolutely right. So do you do an enormous amount of traveling to all of these different communities to work on this project? This is a big job.
Yeah, we do. We do a fair amount. I mean, so what we did is once we broke the country into these 12 parts, we identified, using this data, kind of really good examples of each type of place. And then I've been traveling to those places really for the past 20 months now, and I've been to each one three or four times.
Oh, my.
And we're actually going to do a big set of pieces for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer in December, where we're going to visit five different communities of these patchwork communities around the country and kind of look at how the recession has played out in them. Because the idea that there is this, you know, there is a national recession, numbers are national, that's fine. But when you go to these different places, the realities are very different. Some places it's really all about unemployment. Some places it's the foreclosure crisis just hammering them. You know, you go to big cities, and big cities are kind of experiencing both ends. I mean, there are some wealthy people in the big cities, and there are a lot of poor in the big cities. So we're going to go to these different places, and that was what we did. We've done a couple of these trips now. They're going to air in December, and we're looking at how the economies are different and how they're dealing with kind of the pain, that the economic pain the country's going through.
Mm-hmm. And what about the foreclosure crisis, Dante? Is that we keep hearing reports that maybe it's easing some. Is it easing some or not?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, last month was another not so great month in terms of what the foreclosure numbers looked like. But I think that they're going to start to turn around, okay? That they're turning around slower than everybody thought they would. Some places are really having a much harder time with foreclosures than others. But I think we're at the point now where it's not even just about the foreclosures anymore. If foreclosures are just kind of the last ditch, look how horrible things are. People are losing their homes. There are some places that are wealthier where maybe the foreclosure crisis isn't quite so bad. But, you know, the bottom line is there are tons of homes for sale. Tons of homes for sale, and that means the value of all those homes has dropped dramatically. I mean, this is the place I go to, Eagle, Colorado, which is our boom town that we look at, and it just, you know, it doubled in population essentially in about a 5 or 6 year span. And the foreclosure problem is not great there. They are starting to have it, and for the first time in anyone's memory, there's actually a soup kitchen in town, which is amazing in a place like Eagle, you know, startling. But what's really happened is the number of homes for sale in Eagle is just remarkable. It's remarkable. I mean, it's more than she just wrote about this last week. There are more than 180 homes for sale in that town. There's only 6,000 people in town, and you know, so their property values are down 20%. And so it's not just about the foreclosures. It's about property values, and it's ultimately about, you know, what do you do with all these homes for sale in places? You know, the housing market, it's going to take a long time for the housing market to stabilize. And, you know, those homes that are for sale, if the market stays bad long enough, at some point do they become foreclosures? That's what we have to see. But I just think the foreclosure number is really just kind of the tip of the iceberg. We all pay a lot of attention to it, but it's the tip of the iceberg to what's really going on in the housing market.
And when you look at the reasons for those foreclosures in that community, is it loss of jobs, Dante? Or?
Well, it's really interesting. That entire community, the economy had been built around construction, and there are a lot of places like this in the United States where what happened? Well, there was a housing boom, and people started building things, and then I own a construction firm, and you own an architecture firm, and you know somebody else does HVAC, you know, and we're all rolling in money because we just keep building and building and building, and it looks like it's never going to end, and then it ends. And all those people, when times were good, were living on, say, wow, my income is $150,000 a year. Well, it's not anymore.
Right.
Their income is $60,000 a year or $70,000 a year, you know, and so it's halved or maybe more than halved. So they've got a cushion maybe to allow them to sustain themselves for a while. But at some point, you know, what happens to the cushion? What happens? They've got to sell those homes, and they're upside down in their homes or underwater or whatever, you know, phrase you want to use. There are entire communities like that in this country, many of them. And for them, the foreclosure crisis is very real, and it's going to be with them for a long time. It's going to remake those communities. They're going to look very different in 5 years.
Hmm. Dante Cheney is our guest, and we're talking all things political, as we always do on Monday at 9. Dante is the project director of the Patchwork Nation Project for the Christian Science Monitor. They've identified 12 types of places across the U.S. which are distinct voter communities, and some of them are faring well. Nobody's faring splendidly, I guess, but some of them are faring better than others. The breakdown of these communities is very interesting. Actually, if you want to look at them, there's also a map you can go to online that looks at all of these. So instead of red state, blue state, it's all of these 12 different communities. That's patchworknation.christiansciencemonitor.com. Actually, it's csmonitor.com. So the word together, patchworknation.csmonitor.com. And also, as Dante said, it's going to be featured, their work, in a on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer in December. Well, I don't even know whether we should try and give the phone number. We'll give the phone number and see. We'll try one more time. I'm sorry, everybody. But, you know, you can send an email. That's working, isn't it? Yeah, emails are working at this moment. Phones are a little messed up, but here is – we'll give you the number, and let me give you the email address, starting with email, which is now I've even forgotten the email address. If you want to try talk@WPR.org, thanks. Talk@WPR.org, and we'll try the phones again. That's 800-486-8655. Dante Cheney is our guest. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second of our program this Monday, Matt Taibbi will be joining us. He's had an incredibly interesting career. He's a writer for the Rolling Stone and has written his recent articles about healthcare reform and how messed up the whole process is. So he will join us the second hour. Dante Cheney has returned to our program. We haven't chatted with him in a long time. Correspondent for the Monitor's, Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project, and has been identifying all these places across the United States which are distinct voter communities. We have talked about the economy mostly this hour. He's originally from Detroit, which has been hard hit, looking at healthcare reform and popularity of the president, the press, etc. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Mitch from Green Bay, hello.
Hi.
All right, it's working. Hi, Mitch.
Yes. Well, with the Federal Reserve note as a unit of debt, it's borrowed, how are we ever going to straighten this whole thing out when all we're doing is we're pushing ourselves further and further away from, like you said, the manufacturing of things? And I mean, we don't make anything in this country. It's what is it, 12% of the GDP?
Yep.
Is the number you put out was what we manufacture in this country. What real all it is more recycling of debt and creation of debt rather than a system where we actually manufacture anything or make anything useful for people.
Well, I mean, I do think, and I'm not necessarily opposed. Look, the government does have to spend some money here, I think. I do think that you have to... what we're going through right now requires some kind of investment from somebody, because if we can't just say, well, the system will get will sort its way out, and we'll get through all this, because it can, but that'll make everything a heck of a lot more painful even than it's going to be. I think that, you know, the question with the government spending money on things is are we spending it wisely? I do think there's a legitimate question there, and I think that we should all get ready for, you know, I don't know if we're going to have another major stimulus plan or something like that, but I think that government involvement or government expenditures really over the next decade, it would not surprise me if that becomes, I mean, not the massive amounts we've seen maybe, but it becomes more and more a part of how things operate for a while. Now, you know, the way you get out of it eventually is you start growing your economy again. What you hope is that when you grow your economy, you're growing it fairly, so that a lot of people are benefiting. I think that's going to be the real challenge. I mean, I think when I look at where this economy is going, and we look at these communities, and you see a lot of haves and have-nots, and fixing the problem so that there's really a middle class again, that's a real challenge. I don't know how we do that yet.
Hmm. Thank you very much for the call, Mitch. Jim is next from Beaver Dam. Hi, Jim.
Yes, I'd just like to comment. I'm a dairy farmer out here in near Beaver Dam, and you made the comment that right now the agriculture sector seems to be riding this pretty decently,
right,
or better than a lot of other areas. And I think primarily that is because we're living off our equity that we built up from the crisis we had back in the 80s. I don't know what the future holds. I'm 63 years old and am dipping into my savings to maintain the operation of my farm.
Yep.
My milk income is down 40% of what it had been a year ago. And I don't know how it takes me a lot longer to build back my equity than it does to lower it. And
are you a big dairy operation or a fairly small dairy operation?
Well, I'm mid-sized. I guess by today's standard, I'd be a smaller operation.
Right. I mean, that's what we're finding. I mean, it's interesting what you say. That's exactly what we've heard. And when we go out to Susan, Iowa, which is where we were a couple weeks ago, this is what we're hearing from everybody, that, you know, these communities, these agricultural communities learned a lot of lessons in the 80s when they really took a hit, and they thought, you know, we're going to be a heck of a lot more careful. We're not going to spend crazily. You know, we're not just going to go out and borrow. And the banks are much more careful of how they lend in those places. The people tend to be much more careful about seeking loans in those places. But, you know, the bottom line is they've stretched it out for a year now, probably, right? Or where things have been a little down. And the question is, how much longer can they hold on? And I do think that it's the small to mid-sized places that are really getting squeezed. Because the question is, like you say, how much money do you keep spending before you just decide that, look, this isn't worth it to me anymore? And I think that one thing that's probably going to come out of all this is a further kind of conglomeratization of agriculture in the country.
A 40% drop is pretty significant, isn't it, Dante?
Yeah, it's enormous. Yeah. And, I mean, when we were there, we were talking to cattle farmers, too, and they're getting $150 to $200 less a head, you know, on average for the cattle they have. You know, so and the grain farmers are still doing relatively well. I mean, that's the interesting thing about breaking the country down this way. You can kind of zero in on these places and get a real feel for how they're doing. And, mm-hmm. and it is true that, like I say, agricultural America is doing well right now. The question is, you know, where are they in 6 or 7 months from now when the economy is, quote-unquote, turning around? Are they starting to hit the trough?
Right. Thanks, Jim, for the call. Patty from Eau Claire, hi.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I'm really concerned that for the middle class, the worst is yet to come. I consider myself part of the middle class. And what I'm seeing would be funny if it wasn't so painful, and that is wages are dropping, but everything else is going up. My property taxes in Wisconsin, I was just told that my house value jumped $57,000 in 1 year.
Woo.
Well, guess what? I've had that house on the market for a year.
Yep.
And the realtor says, you got to drop it $30,000.
Mm. Yep.
And then I work a couple of part-time jobs for two different companies that said, they don't even give cost of living raises. They don't give merit raises. They don't even have face-to-face evaluations anymore. And I guess it's because they're afraid you might ask for a raise. And everything, my garbage bill went up 356%. Earlier,
wow,
they want to put a tax on beer. I mean, everything's going up except for wages. And something will break. And we will need a revolution if we don't get the attention of the people in power, because, I mean, it's just getting glaringly obscene.
I do, and yet that's, I think that everything you say, I think I hear from a lot of different people. And, actually, you know, it's interesting statistically, you know, between 1972 and 2007, the productivity of the American worker grew by about 90%, while wages declined by 11%, I mean, in real terms. I mean, so that's very troubling. I mean, the way we've broken up the country this way, I hope what we're able to do is these big cities and these kind of wealthy suburban areas do kind of tend to dominate the media because they're where the media centers are based.
Right.
And the idea of getting out to show other places and what's happening there, we hope will ultimately draw attention to this. The other thing I do think, though, just generally in the United States of America, it is government by crisis. It's really hard to get anything done until the wheels start coming off, and then everybody, we jump in and we try to quickly fix something or do something we can to fix it. I think that it's dawning on people that here, I think in Washington, everywhere, that this is what's going on now is different, and it's going to require something different in terms of a response. Let's see what that looks like and hope we can get through this next coming decade here.
Thanks, Patty. Nellie is next from Madison. Hi, Nellie.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Hi.
Thank you for this wonderful program and for your guest. First of all, I have one point before I have my question. Healthcare costs nothing compared to Afghanistan, Iraq, and all other military enterprise. And I wish there would be some column in the paper showing the comparison of costs. Healthcare is nothing, and we can afford it. That's a choice to be made. My question, my comment has to do with the use of growth all the time, and I guess your guest is an economist. So everybody talks about growth, 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 and how come nobody talks about what is now being discussed in Europe? And I cannot find the equivalent in English. In French, it's décroissance, because croissance is growth, so it would be degrowth or agrowth, but meaning the economy would not be based on consumerism, because that is not possible. We can't go on like this, especially with a crisis in the climate. So that's my comment. If your guest can give me an equivalent for what would be used for degrowth, or is anybody in this country talking about this, I would love to read about it.
The White House and the Obama people understand that they have two real problems. And one real problem, obviously, is we have a recession, and what you need to do to get out of a recession is people need to spend money so that you're not in the recession anymore. But at the same time, obviously, the problem when you look at the American savings rate is we've spent too much. So they're in this really difficult situation where they understand that the answer is we actually have to consume less, probably over the long haul, because we can't go on buying the way we've been buying and spending the way we've been spending. But at the same time, they need people to spend right now. I think over the long term, I think most people, I think a lot of economists, and I'm not an economist, I'm just a journalist, but I've been, this is when I've spent a lot of my, this project has focused a lot on the economy over the last year. And I think that there are a lot of economists out there who will tell you that the American standard of living is just going to change. And that means we will be living kind of less that lifestyle, maybe just by it's just by the circumstances we're in. And I think whether people talk about it or not, it just may be the coming reality.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nellie, very much for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Jeff from Winneconne. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. Your guest earlier said that the unions were the cause for most of this.
Oh, no,
he didn't say
they were the cause of most of it, but I do say they bear some responsibility, yeah.
Okay. Now, what it is that all the big rich people took all of their companies overseas, and they started their companies over there. Now, you know, to produce a pair of tennis shoes in the United States, it would cost $5 more. You could give everybody a decent wage. People right. cannot live on $7.50 an hour.
I agree. And what I was saying about the unions was, I mean, having grown up in Detroit, look, the unions were integral to the rise of the middle class in this country. I think there's no question about that. But I do think that, you know, do the unions bear some of the responsibility for what happened in the auto industry in particular? Yeah, I think they do. I don't think they bear the brunt of it. I do think that that's really been overplayed. But, you know, did they, like anybody else, you know, get greedy when times were good? Sure. That's what human beings do. And, you know, I don't think that, but I don't, you can't say that they're not responsible. The industry is responsible. You know, the unions are responsible. It's bigger than that. It's just kind of about the attitude in the country at that particular moment in history, and it's gone now.
Dante, thank you so much for being with us. What a wonderful project you're directing to. It's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dante Cini, our guest this hour, he is the project director for the Christian Science Monitor Patchwork Nation Project. You can find it online by going to patchworknation.csmonitor.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder for on-air production. We'll be back with more conversation following the news.